Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. Before we start, we acknowledge the original custodians of the lands from which we broadcast, and also the traditional owners of where you may be tuning in from, right around the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service or streaming on our app or from our website. I'm joined in the studio this morning by Alan McSporran from the Triple C. Good morning, Alan.
Morning, Carver. How are you?
I'm very well, mate. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mate, for the people who don't know or aren't familiar, who and what is the Triple C?
Triple C is the Crime and Corruption Commission Queensland. We are the anti-corruption and crime agency for Queensland. We're fundamentally a law enforcement agency, but we have a very particular role in preventing corruption and crime. And that's, in my view, our most critically important role.
Yeah.
To assist communities like yours and individuals from your communities understand their obligations and how they should report a misconduct and bring it to us confidentially, and we will help them resolve those issues and investigate if necessary.
And it's a pretty important role the Triple C holds, but we always like to get a bit of a background of our guests. How did you find your way into this line of work? Naturally, you've got QC behind your name, so you've spent a time in legal practice?
Yes. My background is that I'm a barrister, and I started off as a prosecutor. And then went into private practice and was at the private bar practicing as a barrister, mainly in criminal law and administrative law for over 30 years. And then I applied for this job as chairperson of the commission about 3 years ago, and I've been there ever since. With my background, I have a background in law enforcement, criminal law, so I understand the role. But it's a broader role than that. As I say, it's largely about prevention as well, which is critically important.
And so as chairman, it's not, I guess, a necessarily executive sort of role. What is the role of the chairman and what is the sort of work that you do and the role that you have for the
chair of the commission? I'm a full-time chairperson. I have a deputy chairperson who's another lawyer who's part-time. He's a barrister at the private bar. We then have three part-time, what are called ordinary commissioners. That's Anne Tiernan, who's an academic from Griffith University, Deborah Halliday, who's a barrister in private practice, and Marshall Irwin, who's a retired Chief Magistrate District Court Judge. So that makes up what is, in effect, our governing board. And I'm the head of that. In conjunction with the executive leadership team, I run the organisation. I have a CEO who attends to most of the administrative functions, and most of my role is to supervise the operational aspects of the organisation.
And so you've recently been doing some travelling around. You sort of began to refer to it earlier in the stuff you do around corruption and particularly a better understanding of, you know, governance laws and regulations and that sort of stuff. What is the sort of work that you've been doing, I guess, with particularly Indigenous communities?
Well, I think one of the challenges everyone faces in this area is that we're based, as you know, here in Brisbane, but our jurisdiction and responsibility extends to all over Queensland. And in particular, the remote Indigenous communities are just that. They're very remote from the southeast corner. We take very seriously our role to, in the main, assist those communities understand and enable us to understand the challenges they face and try and assist them to properly manage their communities with transparency and accountability. The only way that can be done, I think, is firstly to have them understand who we are and, in particular, who I am. I've taken the trouble, and it is some trouble because they're so remote, as you know, to start a visiting campaign. I'm just about to embark on my fourth visit, which will complete the first round of visits to all of the communities in Queensland. And I must say I found that fascinating. I've been warmly received, and I think it's been a very useful exercise to, in the first place, let them know who I am, me to know who they are, and to start to establish some respectful, trusting and productive relationships with those communities so that we can effectively have them understand that we want to help them. Mm. And that they can pick up the phone, they can come and see us, and we'll be more than happy to do what we can to resolve their problems. Mm. So I'm delighted with those tours. I love going to those communities. I love meeting the people who are there. And as I say, almost without exception, we've been warmly received and been very positive interactions.
So do you work with predominantly Aboriginal Shire councils and local government?
Yeah, we have a standard procedure when we go to the communities. It's all by pre-arrangement, obviously, and by consent. But we meet with the councillors, including the mayor, if they're available. And then we also, after that, meet with the community justice groups. And if possible, we meet with the police on site and any other community group that is willing to meet with and speak to us. So we get a sense of who the community consists of, what they've been doing, and more particularly, what we can do to help them.
And is this a first for yourself in terms of working within Indigenous communities and meeting, you know, Indigenous mobs?
Pretty much so, Carver. Although in my previous career as a barrister, I did a lot of work in Mount Isa, Rockhampton, Townsville, out west, Cunnamulla, Roma, Charleville. A lot of those places, as you know, have significant Indigenous populations. And as you also know, unfortunately, often the Indigenous population is disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system, which I was part of. So I came to know from that side of the house pretty much a lot of the things that are relevant to my current role, but the current role is much broader than that. It's about general governance and transparency and so forth, conflicts of interest, how to manage all of those things. Like, these communities are responsible, for instance, allocating community housing. They're small communities, there are lots of relationships. It is often very hard to avoid a perception that there's been favouritism in the allocation of those resources. So we need to tell the communities and have them understand ways they can protect themselves from those sorts of perceptions by simply documenting that there are relationships, but that wasn't the basis for the allocation. The allocation was made on merit for these documented reasons. And just little things like that to give them some assistance to understand how they can help themselves avoid the complaints about showing favouritism to relatives and friends and so on. So we're trying to be very practical about it rather than any high-level interaction. It's all down to the nitty-gritty practical tips that are designed to help.
Is this something that CCC have always done, or is this sort of came out of a, I guess, targeted focus to assist and work with Indigenous communities, particularly around that governance space, or is this something that you do for Ipswich City Council, who could probably use some as of late?
It's an initiative across the public sector, but frankly, because of their remoteness and uniqueness, the Indigenous communities have their own set of complex, separate problems, which we're making a target and focus of for those reasons, that we can understand that it is something that's quite different and needs a special, focused, individual solution. Can't do that without understanding, going there and seeing what those problems are, listening to those on the ground and getting a sense of what's required.
But do you do this for mainstream sort of clientele and that sort of stuff in terms of informative or information educational packages and processes and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, we do. Yeah. We have a lot of resources on our website, but we regularly do presentations to public sector agencies like government departments in Brisbane. I go and speak to the education department, the health department, the board of the health hospital services. Wherever we can, as part of our prevention role, we get out into the community and speak face-to-face to enhance and promote the availability of our online resources and ways that we might be able to help those communities.
Yeah, it's one of those fundamental principles, I guess, of our societies, those checks and balances. And there was a time where there wasn't the CCC in the state of Queensland. I think, you know, a lot of older people would sort of remember that. I know we reminisced last time you were here. Of course, our chairperson, Uncle Cole Dillon, was instrumental in, you know, the establishment of the CCC. Do a lot of people you find remember that history and understand that role? Or is there a process, I guess, of getting people up to speed and this is who we are, this is what we do? And
well, that's right. I mean, I think that we tend to forget, and I lived through, I was at the bar and aware of many of the problems in the police service when Fitzgerald Inquiry started. And I knew a lot of the people involved. I knew a lot of the outcomes and those individuals that were involved. And many people in the current generation wouldn't even know about Fitzgerald, have never experienced a life pre-Fitzgerald. But they need to understand that history to understand the need for that ongoing agency like ours to prevent corruption occurring in the future.
And how long has it been now?
30 years since Fitzgerald. So it's almost a generation. But it's a landmark event that we should never forget. We should all understand the history. And Cole, your president, Cole Dillon's experience is a landmark pointer to how simple it is to be compromised and have your integrity destroyed. Cole Dillon, as you know, was offered as a bribe, effectively, to get him compromised and on board with those corrupt police officers. He was offered a bottle of scotch, which he put in his locker. And then when Fitzgerald started, he came forward, produced that evidence of the attempted bribe and to spill the beans. And he's a hero. And what I didn't know until he spoke at our NAIDOC ceremony, might have been 2 years ago now, as a guest speaker, he said that when he first joined the police force, it was 1965, I think, so it was pre the referendum. And he was sworn in as a police officer, and his sergeant said to him on the day of his graduation, son, you're never going to go anywhere, you're just a black man.
Mm.
And that was the reality. And for him to have stuck out that sort of treatment and rise to the level he did as sergeant, and to behave with the ultimate integrity he did, is a shining example to all of us. We revere him, we honour him, and the bottle of scotch that he produced sits in our showcase museum, display case, on our second floor reception area in the our premises in the valley.
Mm.
For a very, very good reason. It's a prime example of how easy it is to be corrupted.
And, you know, this is stories from the, you know, my father and my old people. It's the standard of relationship between particularly police and our communities has not always been ideal, which is well known. And even the understanding for a lot of people at that time that there was corruption within the force. And when it was an Aboriginal man to stand up and be the first to give evidence in that Royal Commission, I know that a lot of our mob felt very proud. I always recall, as a young fella, many of my old people saying, he's a good man, that man.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly right what you say. And we have the same belief about him, and he's an icon. But that's a very important point too, that the part of the role of the CCC is to oversight the police force. And as you correctly point out, the relationship between the Indigenous community and the police force has not always been good. If there are difficulties in that relationship, we need to know about them. We are the body responsible for investigating police misconduct and to oversee the internal ethical standards unit of the police force investigates police. If we don't like the outcome, we have an ability to challenge it, to either take over the investigation ourselves or to take it on appeal to the Queensland Civil and Minister of Tribunal. So what your community should understand is that we are part of the mechanism to ensure that any misbehaviour towards individuals of your community can be reported to us, will be taken seriously and, if necessary, investigated and, again, if necessary, prosecuted.
Mm.
Things like excessive use of force, disrespectful bullying behaviour, harassment, ill-treatment of any sort, that's not to be tolerated. And to be fair, the police service is continually taking seriously those sorts of allegations. But we're the ultimate oversight body of them. If they drop the ball, if they don't treat seriously enough those sorts of allegations, we can tell them they've got it wrong and that we can fix it.
What's the usual process there? Like, say, you know, for example, a mother comes home to find a son who's a bit battered and bruised and had a, you know, poor encounter with police. What would be the usual process there? Calling the police, or would they be calling the CCC? Does the ethical command have to investigate before you fellas can? Like, how does it work?
No, it can go any number of ways. If the person was comfortable enough to complain directly to the police, not the police who are involved, but the police hierarchy, the management, they could do so. We would then assess the complaint with the police to see whether they should investigate it, or if not, it was more serious, we should take it over or let them do it subject to our monitoring. But by all means, it's necessary to understand that if the people are concerned about their treatment at the hands of the police, and for that reason alone, they don't feel comfortable going to the police to report it, they can come directly to us. They can go do it online, they can do it on the phone, or they can come in person in the valley to report it in person. Any number of ways they can do it, we get wind of it, we can then assess it, and if necessary, as I say, investigate it by speaking to those complainants and others to see what the facts were. So that's an important message from us to you and your community, that you need to feel able and you are encouraged to report misconduct to us. Doesn't have to be just the police, it might be your treatment in the community somehow. Our jurisdiction is confined to public officials, but by all means, you should always feel free to come to us and complain. If we don't have jurisdiction, we might be able to refer you to someone who does have jurisdiction, might be the Ombudsman or and so on, or any discrimination commissioner and so on, or it might be stuff that we can do ourselves. But part of this tour we're doing is to develop relationships so you come to understand that we are serious about protecting you and helping you. If you do the wrong thing, we're not going to protect you, but if someone's done the wrong thing to you, we will support you and right the wrong.
Night. that I found never wasn't for you. Now what make it through wasn't for you. Just hearing your voice, I am down the telephone line.
If you're working within the health sector, listen up. The Institute for Urban Indigenous Health is hosting the IUIH System of Care Conference on Monday 27 and Tuesday 28 August at the Brisbane Convention and Exhibition Centre. It's a chance to learn about a health delivery model developed by the Institute for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that is nationally recognised and proven to work. You can also increase your knowledge about the health sector too. So whether you work at an Aboriginal medical service, a community-controlled health organisation, in public health or public service, the IUIH System of Care Conference is worth checking out. To purchase tickets to attend the conference, visit iuih.org.au or for more information, email events@iuih.org.au.
A message from the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health.
This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
In the studio this morning, Alan McSporran. There is, and I think this is a long-standing sort of question, there's always been this doubt, I guess, about the effectiveness of the CCC and this perception that it's police investigating police. Naturally, I'm sure that you're aware of this and people within the CCC are aware of this. How do you sort of counteract that or sort of, you know...
Well, I can understand absolutely the optics around that. As you say, police investigating police, Caesar judging Caesar. It's something that's routinely complained about to us and about us. I can absolutely understand the perception, but I can absolutely guarantee the community that the police at our agency, who are seconded on 3 to 5 year rotations, They come from the police force. They come into us. We only take the best of the best. They are extensively vetted before they come to us. Anyone with a disciplinary history of bad treatment of anyone, let alone Indigenous individuals, would never get a gig at our place. We're very particular for obvious reasons.
So you do turn down candidates?
We turn down. We absolutely. You have to understand that we have 85 police seconded to our agency. It's not a huge force, so everyone is expected to pull their weight. And by pulling their weight, I mean to behave, not only productively, but with the utmost integrity. And police who come to us and do that, there is no greater mark on their integrity and boost for it than having us say that. When they go back to the police force, they're an absolute asset because they get it, they understand how to behave, and they promote a healthy, transparent culture. So further, not just police at our place investigating police. We have multidisciplinary teams. We have accountants, civilian investigators, lawyers, and every decision goes through our executive leadership team, including myself. I can assure you that if an investigation by any police officer seconded to our agency into police fails to measure up, they find out pretty quickly and they're told how to do it properly or they're removed from the job. That very rarely happens because, as I say, the people we have are trustworthy and do the job properly and they're expected to. We have crime division and corruption division, but no one is siloed in either one. They're rotated. They're expected to do both. So we take that pretty seriously. And we have ability, as I said before, if we're not satisfied with the ultimate outcome, we can refer it to a review process. So there are safeguards, but the perception is something we'll never fully overcome. But I can assure you and your listeners that we take that impediment seriously and we are on guard against it being anything more than a perception.
You spoke sort of earlier about that, about the varied roles. One thing that we all see constantly, it seems like every other month, whether it be in Queensland or another jurisdiction, that overrepresentation, there are so many of our people that are coming into contact with the criminal justice system, and sometimes our people do pass away, whether it be in police custody, whether it be in prison. Does the CCC have a role in relation to deaths in custody, and what is that role?
We have a very specific role by effectively a memorandum of understanding between us and the police service, so that if any death occurs in custody, and that definition of what is a death in custody is very broad, it can be as simple as a police pursuit, and someone dies in a collision as a result of that pursuit. That's deemed to be a death in custody. Even though it might seem to be quite remote, like no one's actually in custody, the definition is broad enough to include that. And the reason for that is that not only does it give the coroner jurisdiction, but it is required to be notified to us very promptly by the police service. It's called a significant event. It's done to us immediately so that we have the option of deploying investigators to the scene to oversee the police investigation of the crime scene and the circumstances. So if, for instance, someone actually dies in a police watch house, we're told we would send someone to the watch house, we'd secure the scene, we'd oversee how the police are handling the investigation, and we would then review what they've done and decide whether it's adequate. And if not, we'd tell them what they should do. If they don't do it properly, we'd take it over entirely. So that's a protocol that works very well. And where they don't notify us promptly, we are critical, and we say publicly we're critical of that failure. So it's a pretty robust system, and it has to be because we need, as the oversight body, we need to be on the ground floor to get there and see exactly what's happening.
Well, it's well known that, I guess, the shortcomings and the gaps in the police investigation with relation to the death in custody on Palm Island in the early 2000s. And the effect, naturally, that failures and gaps in an investigation in that early stage can have on the end result of a prosecution or potential conviction is huge.
Yes.
Huge fact. So I guess the need for that is very obviously clear. Working particularly, you know, in that space, it's not just Indigenous people who die in custody or in prison. It's all, you know, all people who find themselves in contact with the criminal justice system. But what, if any, do the CCC take into account from, you know, the recommendations of the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody? I mean, is there knowledge of that document? Is that document sort of referred to in some way, shape or form when dealing with Indigenous deaths in custody?
Absolutely. That's a landmark Royal Commission, as you know. It made a large number of important, worthwhile recommendations, not all of which have been implemented. But we're acutely aware of what is determined by that commission and by best practice more generally, what should be happening in custody and what sometimes isn't. part of our role is to call out that the failure to achieve those minimum standards. And I should say in that context, you might or might not know that we're currently in the middle of a public hearing process involving the prison system, which deals more directly with the overall governance of the jails. And because of the over-representation of Indigenous people in jails, especially in North Queensland, Lotus Glen, I think, up north, has a population of Indigenous individuals at about running about 72% of the total population. Townsville Correctional Centre is not dissimilar, and Rockhampton is, again, fairly skewed in favour of those individuals. We're looking to what we think is a need to make recommendations repairing a clearly flawed system, which will be designed to improve prisoner and correctional officer safety and conditions more generally for those in custody. And that will deal with some of the issues that were highlighted in the Royal Commission all those years ago.
You've spoken about your involvement in the criminal justice system, both as legal counsel as well as your current role. Mate, from your work, as I guess you know, of a lot of our mob who've got family and sort of grown up in communities where these things are sort of a matter of life, there's issues that need to be addressed a long time before people find themselves in contact with the criminal justice system. Unfortunately, your role is dealing with, you know, where things go south or things aren't done correctly. But is there a role for the stuff you do around prevention in that criminal justice space as opposed to the governance stuff?
That, as I say, is one of the main reasons we visit the communities, because when you go there, as you know, you see the complexity of the remote location, the lack of employment opportunities, the drug and alcohol problem, the alcohol management plans. Some are dry communities, some are controlled communities with canteens and so forth. There's no easy solution. To my mind, one of the real issues is not having enough activities and employment opportunities to keep the youth occupied. It's very common in those communities, as you know, to have youth roaming the streets at all hours of the day and night. Early hours of the morning, bored, restless, looking to create mischief, not because they're criminals, because they've simply got nothing else to do. That's unhealthy. Things like the Police Citizens Youth Club initiatives. We saw one in Yarracombe where they had not only the program run for the youths, they had a police liaison officer, woman, who was involving the mothers in cooking classes. And by that initiative, had the kids coming into the program with the mothers, and then the father started to come. So it was a family affair, which is exactly what you want. You want parents taking responsibility for their kids and the community taking responsibility for the families, and all of them helping each other out. So part of those initiatives appeal to us to see what ways we can help, if we can, make recommendations and put in place some systems that will help kids get off the street, help families get off the alcohol and drugs, help them report people who are bringing drugs in and bringing grog in when they shouldn't be, because it is destructive of the community fabric and breaks down family values. So all of those things, I think we have a role to play, and we can only play a role if we understand what they are, and that's why we visit these communities.
The part around the investigations, it's such to get back to that, it is such an important thing. Obviously the prevention work that you spoke about, important as well, but do you have Indigenous staff in the CCC who actually are part of these processes and part of these things? I mean, because so often, particularly when you're going to communities and you're talking to mob about education or you're talking to mob about housing and those sorts of things, it's so vitally important, I think, to have people who understand or have some experience in dealing with our people, you know? Do you have staff, mob on staff?
Look, that's been an issue for us. We've had Indigenous complaints officers who are on the phones to, in particular, speak with Indigenous complainants to understand the cultural aspects that might impinge upon the way they report things and fleshing out the complaints. We've also had liaison officers. One of our recent ones, Elsie Dewis, is just retiring and leaving us. We've got a fellow called Chris Lee, who has come back to help us with some of these visiting, listening tours. And we're currently in the process of developing a reconciliation action plan unique to our agency, which we're about to submit in the next couple of months to Reconciliation Australia to get it ticked off. And we have Diane Borchett, who's a Indigenous project officer, who's helping us with the compilation and steering that project through the necessary channels. But it has been a bit of an issue for us to access people who are suitable for those roles and to help us. But I can assure you and tell you that I rely very heavily on those people when we conduct our listening tours to communities, because they are the introduction to our to the communities. It gets us in there with the imprimatur of those people who know us and can vouch for us. The first step in establishing those relationships. The first tour I undertook, where we went to Palm Island, Thursday Island, Arakoon and Yarrabah, we took Tammy Williams, who is now the Deputy Director General of the Families Department, I think it is. But she accompanied us, and she was terrific in giving us introductions. She was known to all of the communities. Mm. I think her family came from up that way. So those things are very important, and we'll always have some staff who identify with Indigenous background. And we part of our RAP plan is to increase the numbers. So we have a...
That's what I was going to ask. You've got a recruitment strategy for...
We do.
Yeah, for Indigenous people. Yeah.
And that's part of our RAP plan. That's important to us. It's another example of our commitment to the communities, that we're serious about engagement and doing something practical to help out.
Well, I guess it's something you've learnt from your travels, mate, is that, you know, our communities are unique, and each community in itself is unique. And the way our communities, the way we function, the way we're organised through our community organisations, through the shires and all that sort of stuff, each community is quite unique, but similar in a lot of ways too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's an overarching culture, obviously, but they all identify with their own family group, understandably, and there are things, cultural things, that are unique to that family group. And that's something I think is they're immensely proud of, as they should be. What I've seen recently, that there is a greater emphasis on retaining their culture and, in particular, their language. One of the places I visited in the last trip at the end of June this year was Pormpuraaw. And in their art centre, I was privileged to meet a couple of the artists and saw some of the books on display. And I'd never seen before, but I was impressed, some of the books about language and like dictionaries. Which is, you know, I think that's wonderful to be able to retain that language and to be, you know, promoting the sale of those books and their art books and their art. I mean, I can see an opening for a greater promotion of the creative aspect of those communities, not just the paintings and the sculptures, but things like fishing benches, tourism benches. They're very, very skillful and talented communities, which... through other circumstances, they have a lot of trouble putting it all together to get those ventures up and running.
Mm.
But there's a lot of work that can be done in that space, I think.
I know they've got Arakoon fishing boat. I've been on that one. I remember when they were building it. Yeah. I don't know how often it gets out, but it's a deadly boat.
Yeah. Well, Lockhart River's the same. You know, I mean, that's just magnificent country up there. You know,
it's
fishing,
beautiful.
The barrow fishing, reef fishing. Oh, it's just wonderful.
Beautiful. Mm. Now, you know, part of these visits is obviously the stuff you've been doing, but, I mean, is there a greater sort of end plan here or a master plan to create a sort of a set of resources specific for Indigenous communities? Is there a bigger picture here? Obviously, it's important to connect and let them know who you are and what you do and the sort of values that yous have, but, is there a bigger plan?
There is, in the sense that ultimately, once we understand what the individual complexities are and the problems they face unique to those communities, we will do more and more over time to tailor-make for those communities plans that might assist them deal with those problems. The example I give is the first tour again at Arakoon. The CEO said to us, you know, it's all very well what's on your website about corruption prevention and so forth, fraud identification, risk mitigation. But look, it's not one size fits all. We're a very small community. We don't have the resources to do those sorts of audits. It just doesn't work for our community. What can you suggest? Well, what we suggested was, the fellow I had with me was our corruption prevention officer, a dedicated officer at our premises. And he spent about half a day with that same CEO trying to customise the resources we have on our website to meet the needs of his community. That's a good example, I think, of practical assistance.
Yeah. And it's that thing of when we're talking about housing and all those other broader issues, you know, a lot of those communities operate under very different governance legislation, you know, the Dogit communities. People can't purchase their homes, you know, which a lot of people don't understand. You tell, you know, average Joe Blow out here on the street that it's all well and good to think, you know, that there'd be jobs there, but the lack of industry coupled with the fact that people can't actually own their homes, it's essentially a different world, you know.
It is, yeah. And you need to understand that, as you say, before you can start to think about how you might address that problem.
Unique challenges is this point I'm sort of trying to make. Absolutely. You know, when they're dealing with their governance issues and that sort of stuff, essentially they operate under not the standard governance, you know, legislation that a lot of other shires and councils do.
I mean, one of the things that shocked me, I must say, and it's obvious when you think about it, as being necessarily the case, although I'm not convinced that it can't be fixed or at least ameliorated, but you go to those communities and there are stores there, a store, so you've got no choice. Some of them better than others, but they're all horrendously expensive. That's a shocking state of affairs because people are on limited incomes, often on benefits, difficult making ends meet at the best of times. In that circumstance, it's very difficult to feed your family in a healthy way because of the cost involved. It's just another part of the unique challenges they face. People in the big cities probably don't even understand. They never turn their mind to it. But that's a very real day-to-day issue for them. And it's something that I think needs to be addressed in some way. I mean, there are reasons why you'd expect it to be more expensive, but I can't get my head around the huge differential in cost.
Yeah.
There must be a way that can be ameliorated.
Oh, well, good on you, mate, for getting out there and taking the time to, you know, to meet the mob and you know, see some of the issues firsthand. And thanks for coming down today and having a yarn with us.
Thanks for the opportunity, Carver. I welcome the opportunity. I think your station is one of the best ways that we can get the message out to a large number of your community members at the same time. But the fundamental message is, you know, come to the CCC because we are on your side and want to help you deal with the unique challenges you face. Come to us and we'll help you help yourself. Thanks.
Good one. Thanks for coming.
What you say, what you do, why can't you see my point today? Look around you, try to tell you, it doesn't seem to matter what I say. People hurting and people crying, and stolen history is here today.
Yeah. steps from a train going west to a platform she feels so familiar. It's nothing like living so from the book she had already read. Red Fern girl, you better love someone. Red Fern girl, know the end might be on you, then the end won't be too far away. The city can sometimes get you, drop a knife deep into your soul. Red Fern girl, you better love someone. Red Fern girl, you better love someone. There's a whole wide world out there waiting for you, you better love. There's nothing lost, then nothing's gained, and there's nothing good about being alone. Just don't let that wind blow you down the path of destruction. Red Fern girl, you better love someone. Red Fern girl, you better meet someone. There's a whole wide world out there waiting for you, you better leave. Too late.
You bloody betcha. For the best country.
Jack Dillon went walking upon a market day. From half a mile outside the town on foot he made his way. Well, once a week he had this job at the sale yard drafting stock. Half the price of the standard wage and a feed was what he got. Jack Dillon, how are we gonna win when we're guilty of their darkest crime of being zipped up in black skin? We're living on the fringes, far below the standard line. Our heritage, they try to take it back and bury it back in time. We're exiled in the very land of our ancestors and gods. Pushed back across our hunting grounds and shot down like a dog. Jack Dillon, how are we gonna win, boy, when we're guilty of their darkest crime of being zipped up in black skin? There's genocide upon our child, our women were raped and beat. Well, the Lord just slammed me in a cell for being on the street. We're living in the riverbeds and in the urban slums. They give us that tag of lazy cats that won't get off their bum. Jack Dillon, how are we gonna win, boy, when we're guilty of their darkest crime of being zipped up in black skin? Well, they'd call us jet black or hybrid. Well, it matters nothing much. We're black, that's that, we're third rate, and they're treating us as such. They mail us welfare handouts and they fed us on sheep guts. They satisfied their conscience. We won't bite the breast we suck. Jack Dillon,
How we gonna win, boy, when we're guilty of their darkest crime of being zipped up in black skin?
At 9 FM.
For the best country.